KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Students with disabilities are students first, and this really has to be thought about as an education program.
What would it mean to move special ed programs from the Education Department to Health and Human Services?
It's Friday, April 4th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Coming up, was conspiracy theorist Laura Loomer the reason Trump fired members of his national security team? She's taking credit.
Also, small business owners are trying to figure out where to make their products as new tariffs drive prices up.
Every manufacturer in the United States we've spoken to has told us, you need to continue making this in China.
Later, a judge rules that a wrongly deported man must be returned from El Salvador.
And how our favorite movies change as we grow up, from Back to the Future to Harold and Maude.
Teaching you to think for yourself and that it's okay to not fit into the status quo.
Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Stocks in the U.S. were in a free fall for a second day today as President Trump continues to push retaliatory tariffs against much of the world. The Dow fell more than 2,000 points for just the fourth time in history. The broader market suffered even higher percentage point losses. Speaking today to the Society for Advancing Business Editing and Writing, Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell says the central bank is taking a wait-and-see approach.
We've taken a step back, and we're watching to see what the policies turn out to be and the ways in which they will affect the economy, and then we'll be able to act. Fortunately, our policy stance is in a good place for us to do that.
President Trump has called on the Fed to take some action, though most economists are calling the current market plunge self-inflicted and outside of the Fed's mandate of full employment and moderate inflation. Looking at the numbers, the Dow dropped 2,231 points. The NASDAQ and the S&P 500 both fell by nearly 6% today. The Trump administration will scuttle a VA mortgage program that, by the administration's own estimate, had saved 17,000 veterans from losing their homes. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports.
During the pandemic, the Department of Veterans Affairs made an error implementing the VA home loan that left tens of thousands of veterans facing foreclosure through no fault of their own. VA finally stood up a fix called VASP late last year. Since then, it has rescued 17,000 veterans facing foreclosure. But some Republicans in Congress don't like the program because it means the VA takes on the mortgages and the risk. They've proposed a different kind of rescue program. Now, VA says it will end the VASP program on May 1st, but has not yet announced any alternative to replace it. Housing advocates and the Mortgage Bankers Association have warned, without any rescue program, thousands of veterans could lose their homes. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
The Trump administration is ordering federal forest managers to boost logging by 25% on public lands. NPR's Kirk Sigler reports the Secretary of Agriculture has released what the administration is calling an emergency order on forest management.
Fast-tracking logging on public land is part of the administration's broader push to onshore manufacturing, in this case sawmills. Trump's agriculture secretary is now ordering U.S. Forest Service managers to expedite timber sales on federal land in the West and loosen National Environmental Policy Act provisions. This is not a new strategy. The previous Trump administration and GOP presidents before him enacted similar measures with mixed results. The obstacles this time include infrastructure. So many sawmills in the U.S. have closed in recent decades, partly due to automation and cheaper imports from Canada. And Trump advisor Elon Musk has been cutting Forest Service jobs, including the agency officials who are needed to plan and approve the timber sales. Kirk Sigler, NPR News, Seattle.
You're listening to NPR. The U.S. Supreme Court today sided with the Trump administration, at least for now, in a dispute over the Department of Education's freeze of DEI-related grants. The administration has taken several grievances to the high court recently. This was the first of its legal theories to stick. By a 5-4 vote, justices allowing the administration to freeze millions of dollars in grant funding for diversity and instructional programs at public and private universities. 5 months after Election Day, the race for a seat on the North Carolina Supreme Court remains undecided, as Rusty Jacobs of member station WUNC reports. A state appeals court has ruled a lower court was wrong to dismiss the losing candidate's challenge to tens of thousands of votes.
Multiple recounts show that Democratic incumbent Justice Allison Riggs leads Republican Jefferson Griffin by 734 votes. But Griffin has challenged more than 60,000 ballots over alleged irregularities without providing evidence. The state elections board dismissed his protests, and a judge backed the decision. Now, a Republican two-judge majority on an appeals court has given challenged voters 15 days to verify their eligibility or risk nullification of their votes. In dissent, the sole Democrat on the panel said the decision would give the losing candidate another shot at winning by disenfranchising legitimate voters. The case could ultimately go to the state Supreme Court on appeal. For NPR News, I'm Rusty Jacobs in Durham, North Carolina.
Crude oil futures prices plunged today along with U.S. stocks and the global markets amid concerns about an escalating trade war. Oil down nearly $5 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation. For nearly a century, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at Mott.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The Trump administration has abruptly fired the general in charge of the National Security Agency, the spy service that collects cyber intelligence. Since taking office, President Trump's team has dismissed several top military officers without providing a substantive reason or any reason at all. NPR national security correspondent Greg Myrie is here. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Ari.
We don't often hear about the NSA. Who was the general running it?
Yeah, he's Air Force General Timothy Hawke. He's been in the Air Force for more than 30 years, much of it in intelligence and cyber, a very distinguished, if low-key, career because of the nature of this work. Now, the NSA chief is a general or an admiral, and presidents typically inherit an NSA director, as was the case here. And there's no fixed term for the job, but they usually serve 3-4 years. Then a president may appoint a successor. But Hawke was in the post just over a year, and there was no sense that his job was in jeopardy. And in addition, his deputy, Wendy Noble, a civilian, was also dismissed.
What do you know about the reason? Why were they dismissed?
Well, we don't know. The White House and the NSA have not commented. However, far-right activist and conspiracy theorist Laura Loomer, who met Trump on Wednesday, praised the dismissals and seemed to take credit. Without providing evidence, Loomer claimed on X that Hawke and Noble were disloyal to President Trump. She described Hawke as a Biden appointee who was, quote, hand-picked by now-retired General Mark Milley. Now, we know there's bad blood between Trump and Milley dating back to Trump's first term, but there was nothing unusual about what happened in this case. Back in 2023, Milley was chairman of the Joint Chiefs. In that role, he puts forward names and recommendations of senior military officers when positions open up. That's what he did, and former President Biden selected Hawke. Trump has acknowledged speaking with Loomer on Wednesday, said she made some recommendation. But the president said he has the final word on any personnel moves.
Well, outside of the Trump administration, how are people reacting to this?
Sharply critical, mostly from Democrats, but also some Republicans. Senator Mark Warner of Virginia and Representative Jim Hines of Connecticut, the top Democrats on the Senate and House Intelligence Committees, both said Hawke was doing an excellent job and they're demanding an explanation. Hawke was among several national security leaders who testified just last week before the Senate and House Intelligence Committees, and he wasn't the one getting the attention. Many questions were directed at CIA Director John Ratcliffe and Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard. They were part of that now infamous Signal chat group regarding the U.S. bombing campaign in Yemen. Hawk wasn't part of that group.
Could you take a step back and explain why this position, director of the National Security Agency, is so important?
Yeah, the NSA is the largest intelligence agency. It won't tell you how many employees it has, but it's believed to be around 40,000, much larger than the CIA. The NSA gathers electronic intelligence. That means it's tapping into phones and computers in foreign countries. And this is in contrast to the CIA, which focuses on human intelligence. One thing you often hear is that material gathered by the NSA accounts for the bulk of what's in the president's daily intelligence briefing, even more so than the CIA. So the head of the NSA holds a critical job, though he operates mostly below the radar.
NPR's Greg Myrie, thank you for your reporting.
Sure thing, Ari.
President Donald Trump wants to move special education programs from the U.S. Department of Education to Health and Human Services. That has raised fears among some students and their families, and it leaves educators with a lot of questions. NPR's Janaki Mehta reports.
Sueli Gwiazdowski was in high school in Southern California a few years ago. She loved her extracurriculars there and remembers thinking,
I really want to be able to stay at the school that has the speech and debate team that I'm part of and remain part of the community I'm most familiar with.
But that became a lot harder when she learned she had a medical condition that would lead her to use a wheelchair for many years. Her campus wasn't wheelchair accessible, and she tried to push for change, but she was forced to switch to another school.
And was in an entirely educationally segregated environment inside of a portable, separate from general education.
Wiazdowski knew she was perfectly capable of learning alongside her non-disabled friends, but she ended up transferring schools three times, and each time to fight for her rights, she turned to the Department of Education.
I was reading all sorts of online resources, and I learned what IDEA was, and I knew that, you know, I was entitled to a free and appropriate public education, that I could advocate for myself.
A free and appropriate public education is guaranteed by IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. The law says disabled students should be afforded the same quality education as their non-disabled peers, which is why Gwiazdowski, who's now a disability rights advocate, worries about what could happen if IDEA is separated from the Education Department.
Quite frankly, had it not been for the publicly accessible resources that the Department of Education has provided to students with disabilities like myself, I probably would not have gone to college.
The Education Department is responsible for making sure states and districts are following the law. They help guide local leaders, and they also send money to school districts. Provide services for disabled students.
A child who has a hearing impairment may need a sign language interpreter or captioning to really follow what's going on in class.
Katie Neese helped oversee special education programs at the Ed Department under President Biden. She says IDEA funding helps pay for those services and staff, but there are a lot of questions about how that process will continue if this program moves to HHS. An Ed Department spokesperson told NPR the agency was reviewing where its programs can be placed responsibly and said the department would do so with Congress and other education leaders. On top of where programs will go, it's also unclear who will hold local leaders accountable and whether the money will reliably get to schools when there have been widespread layoffs throughout the government, including at the Ed Department and HHS.
If you don't have any type of accountability standards or someone to report to, then that leaves room for people to take advantage and not provide the services that they need to provide.
That's Mark Burnett, superintendent of Carroll County Public Schools in rural southwestern Virginia. He says nearly a fifth of his students rely on IDEA funding, and he's worried if the money or accountability go away.
That boils down to people. It's staff and it's kids that don't get their basic needs met.
The Ed Department also investigates civil rights violations, and students with disabilities have historically made up the biggest share of cases. Here's Katie Neese again.
The Office for Civil Rights will investigate those complaints of discrimination. They work with school districts to improve education services and make things just plain better.
But the Education Department cut nearly half of OCR staff. Even before the layoffs, OCR was already stretched thin, and families complained about waiting months on end for their cases to be resolved. Jonathan Butcher says separating OCR from the Department of Education might help those problems.
Moving it to another agency is an appropriate move because I don't think that we have evidence that the U.S. Department of Education has effectively served these families.
Butcher is with the Heritage Foundation, which helped to organize Project 2025, the conservative policy playbook. That document suggests that IDEA should go to HHS.
Change is difficult, and that's why it doesn't happen very often at the federal level. But this is an opportunity to streamline federal processes.
What's really, really critical is that special education is about education.
Allison Barkoff led the agency that oversees disability programs at HHS until last year. She says HHS isn't designed to have expertise in education.
Students with disabilities are students first, and this really has to be thought about as an education program.
Barkoff says special education is intertwined with the education department, and she worries if these programs move to HHS, disability would be thought of as a health concern rather than an integrated part of education. Janaki Mehta, NPR News.
If you visit a mom-and-pop store in America today, you are likely to see a frenzy of number crunching as business owners try to figure out how to cover the costs of President Trump's tariffs. NPR's Alina Selyuk met an entrepreneurial team at a crossroads.
You know the classic Charles Dickens quote, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. Rosalind Goodwin and her daughter Gabby are living a bit of that with their business in South Carolina.
We have been working as a mother-daughter team tirelessly for 11 years, literally from the kitchen table to patenting a product.
They'd invented Gabby bows, plastic barrettes that promised to actually stay put on kids' pigtails, braids, or twists. Here's Gabby Goodwin at age 9 in a video pitch.
They have two faces, so you can see the design both ways, and it has teeth and craters to trap the hair.
They'd been selling Gabby bows mostly online, and then a few months ago came a huge break.
Our dream retailer approached us to launch in 876 stores this fall.
A deal with Claire's, a massive retailer for hair accessories. In a movie, this would be a scene of them popping champagne, non-alcoholic for Gabby, who's now 18. Instead,
there was great pause with this great development.
Because Gabby bows are made in China, and so far this year, the White House has raised tariffs on Chinese imports 3 times, now totaling 54%. That would eat all of Goodwin's profits as a supplier to hundreds of Claire stores.
Is it worth losing money for a dream retailer? And that's the question we had to ask ourselves.
The math looked so tricky, she even solicited business advice about maybe turning down this deal.
Hopefully by the time we launch, we're able to smile about it, but I haven't been able to smile yet.
Goodwin says she wishes she could make her bows in the U.S.
We have, for the last 8 years, been trying to manufacture Gabby bows in the United States. Every manufacturer in the United States we've spoken to has told us, you need to continue making this in China. It's going to cost you 3 to 4 times more to make it here in the United States.
Gabby bows cost $4 for a pack of 10. Goodwin says her shoppers will not spend $12 or $14 on barrettes. So for now, she's trying to raise funds, hunkering down, and preparing to lose money on her huge dream retail deal. Alina Selyuk, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. It has been a rough week for Elon Musk. Tesla, where he still serves as CEO, reported its largest ever drop in quarterly sales this week. Musk also pumped millions of dollars into a failed pro-Trump candidate in this week's Wisconsin State Supreme Court race. So what does all of this mean as the tech CEO turned presidential advisor grows his political influence? NPR's Stephen Fowler has been covering all of this. Hi, Stephen.
Hey there.
So, Stephen, let's start with Tesla, if we can. Its EV sales are down. Its stock value has steadily dropped since the beginning of the year. So what's happening here?
Well, Tesla's role atop the electric vehicle market has seen a rocky road in the U.S. and internationally. There's competitors like China's BYD that are cutting into that dominance, too. The company was offering sales promotions like zero interest financing and heavy discounts before announcing a 13% drop in first quarter sales. There have been protests at dealerships, reports of vandalisms of Tesla cars and Cybertrucks, and folks getting bumper stickers saying they bought one before Musk's embrace of hard right politics. Investors have expressed concern that Musk has been a distracted driver, so to speak, of Tesla while he acts as the face of Trump's Department of Government Efficiency effort.
And Musk is also really the face of Tesla. What has he had to say about the challenges that both he and the company have been facing?
Well, at a rally in Wisconsin, ahead of the state Supreme Court vote he was promoting, Musk said this Doge work was something he believed in, even though it was costing him and his company's money.
I'm not getting paid. Definitely not stealing money and would never get away with it. But the value of my Tesla stock is in half. So this is a very expensive job, is what I'm saying.
I mean, basically, he acknowledges, Juana, that his proximity to President Trump and his policies and being in charge of several high-profile companies is sometimes in conflict.
Okay, I want to talk a little bit more about what happened in Wisconsin this week. The conservative-backed candidate there lost by 10 points, and that's a state that Trump won in November. How involved was Elon Musk in that race?
Here's some numbers. Musk accounted for about $20 million of the $70 million spent in what was the most expensive state Supreme Court race in history. He gave million-dollar checks to voters acting as spokespeople and held a rally ahead of the vote. In a Fox News interview Tuesday before polls closed, he warned that a victory for the Democratic-aligned candidate would have consequences for the whole country.
They're going to do everything possible to stop the agenda that the American people voted for when they voted for President Trump with a popular vote and the House and the Senate in November.
And after that defeat, Musk did post on the social media site he owns, X, that they expected to lose.
Now, I know that there was also a Democratic overperformance in two Florida special elections on Tuesday, though Republicans, I'll note, did hold on to those seats. Did Musk play a factor there?
Well, Democrats have been doing better than expected in special elections during the Trump era, and Tuesday was no different, even when they don't actually flip seats. There's a lot of money pouring in, there's lower turnout with more engaged voters, and now there is a lot of displeasure with Musk and Doge and Trump's policies his first months back in office. Here's a case in point. I went to a, quote, fighting oligarchy rally put on by Senator Bernie Sanders in Arizona a few weeks ago talking to voters. And Sanders told me people are clicking more with his longtime message that rails against the influence of billionaires in politics because of Musk and what he's doing and how he encapsulates that.
Stephen, let's end with this. With trouble on the political front for Musk as well as on the business front, where does Elon Musk go from here?
Well, he's a special government employee, meaning he's not supposed to work more than 130 days in a year. He says he's worked nonstop since January 20th. On Air Force One Thursday, Trump said Musk should stay, quote, as long as he'd like, but also added Elon would probably want to get back to his businesses in the next few months. Conveniently would line up with that 130-day timeline at the end of May.
NPR's Stephen Fowler in Atlanta. Thank you.
Thank you.
Today, a federal judge in Maryland ordered the Trump administration to return a man who was deported to a Salvadoran mega prison by mistake. Kilmar Abrego Garcia was arrested and deported last month despite having been granted protection from an immigration judge that should have prevented his removal to El Salvador. Now a federal judge has ordered the administration to bring him back to the U.S. by the end of the day Monday. This sets up another high-stakes clash between the White House and the courts. NPR's Joel Rose was at the courthouse today, and he's here now. Hi, Joel.
Hi, Ari.
Remind us who this man is.
Yes, he is. Kilmar Abrego Garcia is originally from El Salvador. He's been living in Maryland with his wife and their three children, all of them U.S. citizens. Abrego Garcia was allowed to stay in the U.S., and had a work permit. He has a form of protection known as withholding of removal because an immigration judge found in 2019 that Abrego Garcia was more likely than not to face harm if he was sent back to El Salvador. In spite of that, ICE officers arrested Abrego Garcia in Maryland last month, and a few days later he was deported to El Salvador, along with hundreds of other men who are accused of being members of the Salvadoran gang MS-13 or the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua. Abrego Garcia's family sued. The Trump administration admitted that he was deported by mistake because of what they describe as an administrative error. But the Justice Department argued there was nothing they could do because Abrego Garcia was already out of the U.S.'s hands.
Which apparently was not persuasive in court today. Tell us how it went down.
Yeah, that argument did not go well with federal judge Paula Zinis, who heard oral arguments today. Zinis described the arrest itself as an illegal act. She said, quote, from the moment he was seized, it was unconstitutional, unquote. The judge spent a long time grilling the lawyer for the Department of Justice about the legal authority for this arrest or for Abrego Garcia's continued detention in El Salvador. And the Justice Department lawyer said he did not have the answers to those questions. The judge also asked him why the administration had not tried to return Abrego Garcia to the U.S. when they first learned about this mistake. And the lawyer said he had asked his clients inside the Trump administration the very same thing and never got a satisfying answer. Zinis took a short break after the hearing and then came back and read her order from the bench. She gave the Trump administration until the end of the day on Monday to return Abrego Garcia to the U.S., and you could hear a cheer go up from the crowd that was gathered outside the courthouse to support Abrego Garcia as the judge read that order.
So the deadline is midnight Monday. What is the Trump administration saying about this?
The White House claims that Abrego Garcia is a member of MS-13, but his lawyers deny that. They say that allegation dates back to the time that he was arrested in 2019 in the parking lot of a Home Depot where he was looking for work. His lawyers say that gang allegation is based solely on a confidential informant who accused Abrego Garcia of being a member of the gang in New York, which is a state where he never lived, and on the fact that he was wearing a Chicago Bulls hat and hoodie. Abrego Garcia's lawyers say he has no criminal record in any country, and if the Trump administration had any evidence to support its claims, they did not attempt to submit it in this case. Judge Zinis noted that there was no evidence about alleged gang allegations in front of her. She said, quote, that's just chatter in my view, unquote. And she said, when you present allegations like that in a court of law, they have to be based on evidence, like indictments or criminal complaints, none of which the Trump administration put on the record here.
So just briefly, what happens next?
That is the big question. The Trump administration has certainly been pushing the limits of compliance with other federal courts, including in another case about these same deportation flights. Judge Zinis gave the administration until 11:59 p.m. on Monday night to return Abrego Garcia to the U.S. It is possible they will comply. Late in the day Friday, the Trump administration filed a notice of appeal indicating that they will ask the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals to block this order. But there's still a lot that could happen between now and Monday night.
That is NPR's Joel Rose. Thank you.
You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
Asma Khan is a culinary star and the owner of a hugely successful Indian restaurant in London. So it might sound surprising that she didn't learn to cook until she was an adult.
Even though I'd never physically cooked, I grew up in the kitchen watching my grandmother and my mother cooking.
We talked to Khan about her latest cookbook that covers all the basics. That's on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. 50 years ago today, Microsoft was born.
It started with two friends with a geeky hobby and grew into a company that jump-started the personal computing revolution.
By the end of the 1990s, it was running on nearly every single desktop computer in the world.
That story after the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is trying to reassure NATO allies of the U.S. commitment as President Trump sends mixed messages to the alliance. Rubio met with various NATO leaders on the sidelines this week of a summit meeting in Brussels. He says President Trump has made it clear the U.S. will remain in NATO and that every member must do its part to support NATO financially.
And so we do want to leave here with an understanding that we are on a pathway, a realistic pathway, to every single one of the members committing and fulfilling a promise to reach up to 5% of spending. That includes the United States will have to increase its percentage, because if the threats truly are as dire as I believe they are, and the members of this alliance believe they are, then that threat has to be confronted by a full and real commitment to have the capability to confront these things.
Rubio's meeting comes as the U.S. and NATO members try to broker a ceasefire in Russia's war with Ukraine. President Trump defended his historic tariff actions today as stock markets plummeted. While he had no public event scheduled, the president has been sounding off on social media saying his economic policies are working. Here's NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben.
In one post, Trump says the communist leader of Vietnam told him in a call that Vietnam is willing to cut tariffs on U.S. goods. That's in response to Trump's announcement of 46% tariffs on Vietnamese goods. Separately, Trump posted in all caps that China did, quote, the one thing they cannot afford to do. That is, China announced retaliatory 34% tariffs on U.S. goods. And yet another post aims to pressure Fed Chair Jerome Powell to cut interest rates. Federal Reserve policymaking is independent of the president. Trump is at his golf club in Palm Beach, Florida for the day and will be hosting a private candlelight dinner at his Mar-a-Lago resort. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News.
Stocks were down across the board. This is NPR. Some encouraging news for Bruce Springsteen fans. This summer, the Boss will put out a collection of seven previously unreleased albums. NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento has more on that.
Bruce Springsteen has announced that tracks two, The Lost Albums, will include dozens of previously unheard songs, including this one, Rain in the River. That's a song from an unreleased 2018 album. But the entire collection will span as far back as four decades. And it will connect the dots between some of Springsteen's most notable projects, like Nebraska and Born in the USA. Lauren Anke is a professor of music at George Washington University. She says,
every little piece that can be revealed tells us more about his work as a songwriter and as a singer.
Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento, NPR News.
In Tunisia, snails are inching closer to replacing red meat as people turn to cheaper protein for economic relief. Snails have, of course, long been consumed in North Africa and throughout the world. They cost about half as much, though, as beef per kilogram, and even less when sold by the bowl. High unemployment and low wages in Tunisia have forced many people to return to eating bugs, which are low in fat and a high source of iron. It's also a cheaper, more sustainable alternative to red meat. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from Easy Cater, a business tool for food, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Ailsa Chang in Culver City, California. Almost everyone has a favorite movie, right? But the movie you may have loved when you were 12 might not be the same movie you loved when you were 17, and then 49, for example. Films that capture us can change over time, just as we change over time. And I wanted to talk about that with a couple of real-deal movie lovers, NPR film critic Bob Mondello and NPR culture reporter Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, because I just wanted to reminisce a little about the movies that have meant the most to us. Hey to both of you.
Hey, good to be here.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
Hello. Okay, so I know that both of you spend a lot more time thinking about films than I do, but the cool thing about movies for me is that no matter if you're a professional movie critic like Bob or just a movie goer like me, like some stories just implant in you, right? Mm-hmm. And if I were to start this conversation back in childhood and you asked me what movie grabbed me, like as soon as I watched it for the first time, what movie did I replay over and over again in my head after I left the theater, it would have to be Back to the Future, which came out in third grade for me.
Wait a minute, Doc. Are you telling me that you built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
I had this huge crush on Michael J. Fox, whom I had already adored on Family Ties. But here's the thing about that movie. This movie helped me think about nerds. Like, I always felt like a nerd growing up, even back in elementary school. And watching George McFly rise to become the boss made little Elsa so freaking happy. Was Back to the Future important to either of you? Like, Isabella, were you even born yet in 1985?
Drag me. I was not born in 1985, but I do love this movie.
Boy, in 1985, I was in my, 40s, late 30s.
Ooh, into adulthood.
But as a practical matter, yeah, of course it affected me.
Okay, wait, Bob, what was your childhood favorite?
Well, I had a couple. When I was 10, a movie came out called Journey to the Center of the Earth.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is James Mason. Come along with Pat Boone and me, Arlene Dahl, Diane Baker, and Gertrude the Duck, and discover sights and sounds and wonders no living man has ever witnessed before.
Gertrude the Duck. Now, this movie is about going to the center of the Earth. It's based on the Jules Verne story. Right. It is big and special. And what I remember most vividly about it is that there was a enormous lizard. Somebody stepped on it at one point and it glowed red. And it had looked like it was just a stone. But the thing was like 50 feet long and huge and had a 40-foot tongue. And it was like, oh, my God. Anyway, I think when you're 10 and you're a little boy, that appeals to some aspect of growing up and being rambunctious. I watched that one 4 or 5 times when I was a kid. They let me keep going back to it. So that was me.
I love it. Isabella, what about you? Childhood favorite?
My childhood favorite was Disney's The Aristocats.
Oh, yeah.
It, like, romanticizes Paris. It like, inspired my love for cats. I'm a huge cat lover. I have a cat today. It has a fantastic soundtrack.
I've got that wanderlust. Gotta walk the scene. Gotta kick up highway dust. Feel the grass that's green.
And I think it just opened me up to this adventure of, like, these very privileged cats that are, like, set out into the world to discover, you know, what they've been sheltered from in their very comfortable life. So maybe it also kind of sparked my class consciousness at a young age. I come back to it all the time. It's an incredible movie.
I love it.
That's a real NPR sentiment there.
Totally.
That's very impressive.
Well, okay, what about, like, your teenage years? So for me, like, my favorite movie in my teens was Dead Poets Society. Mm. I think, again, it was about crushes. Like, I had a huge crush on Ethan Hawke and Robert Sean Leonard. Mm. But what I really loved about the film was this idea that
A great teacher could give you the courage to think differently from your parents, which was a thing beginning to form in my head.
And we all have a great need for acceptance, but you must trust that your beliefs are unique, your own, even though others may think them odd or unpopular, even though the herd may go, that's bad.
Even though there were some serious consequences in the movie for that defiance, like, it got me to start thinking about, like, thinking for myself.
Fair.
Elsa, the crush on Ethan Hawke is still very valid today, and I support that point very much. But my favorite movie as a teenager was Harold and Maude, the Hal Ashby movie about this, like, you know, tortured young man who doesn't fit in with his family, and he meets this very eccentric, eclectic old lady who takes him on this big adventure.
Hey, this little thing handles well. Ever drive a hearse, Harold?
Yeah.
It's a new experience for me.
And I think I loved it for similar reasons to those that you're mentioning, Elsa, of like teaching you to think for yourself and that it's okay to not fit into the status quo. And it's probably better to embrace that than to make yourself miserable trying to conform.
Totally.
I saw that picture 19 times
in
my college days.
Wait, how do you remember that number so clearly?
Because it became crazy after a while and I was keeping track. I saw Harold and Maude again recently. And it was interesting to see it with a brand new audience and to realize it works very much the same way for college students that it was working for me way back when.
I need to see that movie again.
It's really lovely.
So how do you both think your movie tastes have changed, evolved over time?
I think what happens as you get older is that you start to gravitate to films. We're talking about films that mean something to me, for instance.
Yeah.
The one that got me, you know, I guess I had been together with my husband at this point for about 18 years. And finally, there was this movie called Brokeback Mountain.
I wish I knew how to quit you.
Then why don't you just let me be, huh? Because of you, Jack, that I'm like this.
It was desperately important to me that this movie catch on. And so I wrote afterwards about its success, about how they had marketed this movie across the country and how it became, for a time, the most popular movie Western ever made and one of the most popular romantic dramas ever made, which astonished me.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
And the fact of its success and the fact that I thought it was a very good movie, it made it important to me at that time in my life.
And so validating, mm-hmm. I imagine.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like I've just graduated to more complex understandings of these themes that, like, even the Aristocats presented. My favorite movie now is Y Tu Mamá También, the Alfonso Cuarón, like, road trip flick, which is obviously one of the first times we see
this magnetic duo. Crushes again, but okay, yeah.
No, exactly. You're catching my drift. You're catching where I'm going with this. The most magnetic duo of Diego Luna and Gael García Bernal, but I think it deals with some of these same concepts of, like, being out in the world and kind of finding your purpose and your place and learning from people who are very different with you and how your internal conflicts manifest in your friendships and your relationships. And I think also, you know, I'm Venezuelan American and grew up in the US. And I think my exposure to, like, capital F serious film was mostly English language and American films. And I think discovering this beautiful tradition of Mexican cinema kind of cracked my world wide open.
That was NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento and Bob Mondello talking about some of their favorite movies over the years.
This is NPR News.
Along the southern U.S. border, where trade is a critical part of the economy, there's a sense of relief that Mexico will not face additional new tariffs, at least for now, and here's why. Thousands of manufacturing plants in Mexico are part of supply chains that extend into the U.S., and the companies that keep the flow of goods moving smoothly across the border are among today's perceived winners amid shifting trade policies. Angela Cocherga from member station KTEP reports from El Paso.
Cargo trucks going back and forth to Mexico rumble past EP Logistics' huge El Paso facility. The company is strategically located near a busy international bridge. Here on the border, tariff uncertainty created urgent demand for warehouses and customs brokerage services, says EP Logistics President Octavio Saavedra.
Nobody really paid attention to us before all these tariffs, and now
we become very popular around here because we're the ones that have to calculate what the implications are going to be.
In anticipation of higher tariffs, companies are rushing their products across the border and trying to figure out costs created by potential new fees. Saavedra's warehouses are filled with goods, including electronic components, medical devices, and a variety of car parts that are distributed through supply chains across the U.S.
All over the country, to their tier one customers, you know, like Honda, Toyota, General Motors, and so on.
There are also finished products like refrigerators.
Yes, these are refrigerators that are coming in from Mexico. These already pay the duties. They clear customs, so they're doing a transload from one trailer to the other.
Mexico is the United States' top trading partner. In the El Paso area alone, trade totaled more than $150 billion last year. Higher tariffs on China during the first Trump administration, along with broken supply chains during the pandemic, spurred growth in this border region. More companies moved their operations to neighboring Mexico.
Good with that, and we saw this big boom here in the southern border. I mean, as you can see, there's a bunch of buildings going up here in El Paso and also in Juarez.
President Trump says his ultimate goal is for manufacturers to return to the U.S., but that will take time, says Tony Payan, director of the Center for the U.S. and Mexico at Rice University's Baker Institute.
It's going to be a very long-term proposition where companies will eventually have to move billions of dollars to do that.
In just the first few months of the Trump administration, the threat of new tariffs before they were imposed was enough to slow growth and investment on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border, says Border Industrial Association President Jerry Pacheco.
And we have companies that have shelved projects to expand their operations, others that are taking a smaller footprint. It's been a struggle to get through this period of time.
And the continued uncertainty about tariffs may determine who survives and who thrives. For NPR News, I'm Angela Kochurga in El Paso.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. Secretary of State Marco Rubio attended a meeting of NATO foreign ministers in Europe this week, just a day after the president announced worldwide tariffs hitting the U.S.'s closest allies. Terry Schultz reports this issue overshadowed the gathering, which would normally be focused on increasing assistance to Ukraine and deterring Russian aggression.
Of all the members of Trump's cabinet, Secretary of State Rubio is perhaps the one on whom European governments pinned their highest hopes for appreciation of NATO. As a senator, he'd co-sponsored legislation that would prevent a U.S. president from withdrawing from the military alliance without the Senate's consent. In Brussels, Rubio did seek to reassure allies concerned about the president's overtures to Russia and longstanding animosity toward Europe.
President Trump's made clear he supports NATO. We're going to remain in NATO.
However, his message was two-pronged, with a hefty price tag attached for those European countries which are only slowly building up their defense investments, even after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine more than 3 years ago.
And so we do want to leave here with an understanding that we are on a pathway, a realistic pathway, to every single one of the members committing and fulfilling a promise to reach up to 5% of spending.
That's 5% of GDP the U.S. wants all NATO governments to allocate for military expenditures. Some of them aren't even close to the 2% of GDP goal made 11 years ago. That demand did not come as a surprise. Trump has mentioned it repeatedly. But this week it carried an extra sting after the president announced a 20% tariff on all European Union goods entering the U.S. More than two-thirds of NATO allies are also members of the European Union. Dutch Foreign Minister Kasper Veldkamp was among those expressing exasperation with the White House move, which is expected to dampen European economies.
The extra money we are willing to spend on defense, we don't want to spend it on inflation. We want to spend it really on equipment, on defense, and increasing our deterrence.
Jonathan Sevioff was Estonia's ambassador to the U.S. during Trump's first term. Now the Secretary General of Estonia's foreign ministry, he refuses to get rattled about reports that while the U.S. may not withdraw from NATO, it may withdraw forces from Europe, step back from leadership roles, or transfer some of its unique military capabilities to the Asia-Pacific region. Sevioff says obviously these changes would be problematic for Europe, but...
But that wouldn't in of itself change the risk matrix of Estonia. I mean, we would then simply have to do more on our own. And it's better to be prepared for that eventuality today, especially considering that developing military capability takes time, even if money is not an issue.
Whatever recommendations Rubio takes back to the president, he will have been reminded how seriously other countries take NATO solidarity. 4 U.S. soldiers died on a training mission last week in Lithuania, which Rubio himself cited as evidence of U.S. engagement with the alliance. Lithuanians raised tens of thousands of dollars to send to the soldiers' families, and hundreds of people lined the streets of the capital Vilnius to pay their respects as the bodies were sent home. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
Today is Microsoft's 50th birthday. It created software that made computing accessible to everyone. From member station KUOW in Seattle, Monica Nicholsberg reports, and a note, Microsoft is a financial supporter of NPR, but we cover them like any other company.
Growing up in Seattle, Bill Gates and Paul Allen were obsessed with an emerging technology called computers. At the time, computers only belonged to geeky hobbyists like them and big institutions. But their idea to sell software would change that. It started with the Altair 8800, a build-it-yourself computer that Allen saw in Popular Electronics in 1975.
Paul saw a magazine ad, this kid computer, and went running to Bill and said, you know, we have to catch this train. And the rest is history.
That's University of Washington computer science professor Ed Lazowska showing off an original Altair. It's about the size of an apple crate, with no screen, just lights and switches on the front. You program it by punching holes into paper.
And you would load the program from the paper tape reader. And you could do that by toggling commands into these switches on the front panel.
Microsoft's big idea wasn't to sell computers, but to build programming for other people's computers. Making software that worked on lots of models and selling it separately was new. Their first programming language was called Microsoft Basic, which they built for the Altair. Lazowska still has Allen's original business cards from those early days.
So these are treasures. It's the very beginning of Microsoft.
At a time when digital technology meant multi-million dollar machines locked in big air-conditioned rooms, Gates and Allen's moonshot idea was to put one on every desk, running Microsoft software.
Now, digital technology is absolutely everywhere. You know, in many ways, it's the vision of Bill and Paul that drove that transformation.
Most people learned of Microsoft's next big innovation because it came pre-installed on IBM's first home computers in the early 80s. It was called the Microsoft Disk Operating System, MS-DOS to its friends. Here's Microsoft fan Michael Bretman running MS-DOS on an early PC at a vintage computer festival in Seattle.
It tells the machine what needs to be done, and in the DOS environment, it's very minimal.
Really minimal. Just a black screen where you type in commands listed in a thick manual. MS-DOS was groundbreaking, but it still wasn't user-friendly. Enter Windows. For author and tech historian Margaret O'Meara, two things come to mind when she thinks back on Microsoft's greatest hits.
Oh, I immediately think of Windows and Office. I think of the system that by the end of the 1990s was running on nearly every single desktop computer in the world.
Unlike MS-DOS, Windows was easy to use. You just had to point and click. Microsoft didn't invent the graphic operating system, but it did make it cheaper and more widely available.
Software, it was a tool you could use in your home, in your school, and in your office. These were no longer separate things.
Microsoft's moonshot was a success. It did land a PC on every desk. Now, it needed a new frontier. Microsoft made software, but its rivals were scoring big wins in hardware. Apple had hits like the iPod and iPhone. But when Microsoft tried to beat Apple at its own game, it failed.
Zune is Microsoft's answer to the iPod. Apple has sold more than 100 million iPods to Zune's 1.2 million.
Microsoft's smartphones were also duds.
Microsoft is pulling the plug on the kid. It's canceled. Dead.
By the time Microsoft was in its 30s, Apple was winning mobile, Google was dominating search, and taking on Microsoft with free Office software. But Microsoft did score some of its shots at reinvention, like the Xbox. It was a hit, thanks to games like Halo and Xbox Live, which let gamers play together over the internet. And what could be Microsoft's most important makeover is underway today. Its cloud computing business, Azure, powers companies all over the world. And with its partner, OpenAI, Microsoft is building artificial intelligence into basically all of its products. Here's Lazowska again.
The company's ability to reinvent itself is remarkable, and that's pretty unusual, right? Many companies just sort of keep riding the same horse and don't change and eventually fade away.
Far from fading away, Microsoft remains one of the most valuable companies in the world. And the proof of that is probably on your desk today. For NPR News, I'm Monica Nicholsberg in Seattle.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to protecting and preserving the planet during Earth Month and every month through the bold power of local and global action. Nature.org/NPR. From Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19, the CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. From Drexel University, whose model of experiential education allows students to choose their own path and explore the world, enabling them to discover their perfect career. More at drexel.edu. And from the John D. and Kathy.
Love me, say you do.